everyone, and welcome to this week's episode of the Data Protection Made Easy podcast, episode 191, I think, with GDPR Radio. Mm-hmm. Yeah, getting close to the 200 mark. I'm joined today by Phil Browning and Katharina Santosh. Thank you both for joining me, and hello.
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 So what did you think of the session? I thought it was quite good. You know, we got really stuck into a few really interesting topics. I think my highlight was talking about the Meta Ray-Bans and, you know, how it's going to be an absolute privacy frenzy, or is it the opposite? Lack of privacy.
A hacker's frenzy.
It's Friday afternoon. The podcast is nearly done.
Yeah, that was a good discussion. I think that was a really good, points all through. But we were linking it to the various, the social engineering attacks. You know, these glasses, would be very useful to a social engineering attacker. Yeah. I enjoyed it. I mean, I don't know if anybody else enjoyed it, but I thought it was a good session. I enjoyed it. I think we covered quite a bit of ground. What did you think, Katharina?
Yeah, I think it was really good. So I think the smart glasses was just because there is a few episode on Black Mirror that is quite around the smart glasses as well. So the fact that we could address concerns around profiling vulnerable individuals, the fact that how can you be under surveillance, aren't you? So how can you address all these concerns? And in the end of the day, who'll be responsible for addressing all these concerns and the privacy of these individuals? I think was a really good session. And I think we touched really interesting points. Yeah.
The other thing that was good was we covered a lot of ground highlighting, the very good work of the ICO, like the audit trackers and the update to their guidance. There's quite a few things we highlighted, training. Highlighted that they've I don't know if anybody went to the conference. That's one of the things I wanted to ask, if anybody had gone to conference and what they thought. But we spent a bit of time highlighting quite a few new resources and the resources that the ICO is putting out this quarter.
And the European Data Protection Board as well, which, while it might not be directly applicable to us, it's still persuasive at least, So they've released draft guidance on legitimate interests and guidelines around the e-privacy directive, which, it might have, it relates obviously to privacy and electronic communications regulations. And I wonder if that will, you didn't really like the guidelines, did you, Phil? But I wonder if it will have any effect on our approach.
No, actually, that's much I haven't read them yet, but what I read about them, I read a blog and then I opened up the guidelines to read, the opinion to read. Oh, guidelines. And what I read about them was that they're fairly inconclusive and they don't really help. But I haven't read them myself yet. I've got them on my desktop to read.
I think even though while we, covered a lot of ground on some specific topics, we also covered a lot of topics as well. There was the ICO's reprimand. There was also consent. We discussed about consent or pay. So it was a really, really interesting session. A lot of insight. I think the chat, the listeners, enjoyed the conversation as well. There were a couple of funny comments in there, so at least they were engaged. Hopefully you think the same listening, and we'll be back next week for a session on AI, so keep an ear out for that one. But in the meantime, enjoy the session. This session is a GDPR radio. If you're new to these, we just talk about all things data protection. We try and keep it as, free-flowing and structured. Definitely not. If you want to get involved, please, unmute yourself or talk in the chat. They are very open. The session is recorded. If you've got any issues with that, there's a privacy notice on screen, or please let us know after the session. And we also will not be allowing AI assistance in the sessions. If you want to know more about that, then listen to the previous episodes.
Yeah, because of customer feedback, people didn't feel comfortable with it.
Now,
I have to say, go on, Jasmine.
Go on, Phil. You have to
I've had to say hello to both of you. Do you know why I've had to say hello specifically to both of you and get it on record? I don't know if you saw, but there's a news article this week in the Telegraph. Not saying hello to a colleague could break the law. A person lost an employment tribunal, or somebody won an employment tribunal, because their boss didn't say hello to them. which was deemed to be unreasonable and aggressive behaviour and tantamount to cause the person to resign, which is what you call constructive dismissal. Constructive dismissal? Yeah. So that was quite surprising. So I make a point now of saying hello to you both.
Oh, wow. Yeah, you've got to watch your back, Phil.
just the fact that can a person being rude can be considered like a reason to just resign.
I know.
And with an employment tribunal.
Yeah, yes. There must have been a little bit more to that, surely.
Well, you can read the news article.
Yeah, aside from that. there's been a lot going on this previous week, hasn't there? There's been a lot of action from the European Data Protection Board and ICO. Yeah. I don't know if you've seen much around that, maybe over the last couple of weeks, actually, around the new ICO's accountability framework or audit framework. Phil, you've been doing some research into that, haven't you?
Yeah, well, not so much research, but because we're doing, as I said, Joe and I are doing this audit next week, I thought I would have a look at the trackers, some of the trackers, because there's not one for everything that you need to audit. So I had a look at them and I wanted to see whether they would be, whether we could use them, for instance, on the audit. I decided in the end it was too risky to use this untried method that we've not really got our heads around. And it's kind of all Excel sheets. So you have to kind of type in and fill them in while you're sat there. And it's some of the pre-canned answers and some of it is free text. So rather than, I should imagine that would break up the flow of a assessment visit and audit. So we're not going to use it. I looked through them though, and there's some really good questions. I think it's a good tool, to be fair.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if you had a chance to look at them as well, have you?
I had a chance to look at them, and to be honest, I think it could be very useful for our the audits and discovery days. I think they made really really nice questions, and the fact that they have ways to meet our expectations, options to consider, and they have like a list of options to consider, considering probably the size of the organizations, what type of personal data can be processed by them, and very nice questions that made you think and to consider for further works. I think is really good.
Yeah, I was just looking for we've got a link somewhere to it in case people haven't seen that. But
I will show you.
Well worth looking at, and well worth kind of, I've downloaded them all and I've read through them all, and they're pretty good. I mean, I looked right through the rights. I thought, well, what questions are they asking about rights? Rights request handling, and it's it's all right. It's all right stuff, really.
Mm-hmm. Find it interesting that there's a section for AI now as well, specifically.
Yeah. Yeah, I looked at that because, I looked in at their guidance on lawful basis for processing with AI, because I thought, well, that's actually kind of the crux of it, isn't it, really, to a large extent, apart from understanding the logic. But a lot of it is, the lawfulness for the initial training and then the lawfulness for the actual use of the AI. And that's quite interesting to read through. It's fairly inconclusive. Basically, it says, it's up to you, but here's some pointers. I'll put a link into that. That's quite useful to look at.
Yeah, thank you.
What they do say is that, legitimate interests can work. They say contract can work, public task can work. They say everything can work. It just depends on the relationship you've got with people and some other factors to consider as well. But it's well worth looking at.
On that point of legitimate interest, the European Data Protection Board has released some draft guidance on its use as well, haven't they? I don't know if you've seen that, either of you.
Yeah, I have seen it. So the European Data Protection, they've drafted these new guidelines. But they already had some and they just added some more detail. But the fact that most concerned me was I was diving into those guidelines and I found nothing around artificial intelligence, and I was hoping that was something around this around the AI training, and considering the latest news in particular around like the LinkedIn and all the AI training, something I was expecting to see some guidance on it or some instructions around the use of the legitimate interest. Obviously, considering the circumstances, but I was hoping to see something around it. Yeah.
It'd be a good opportunity, to have some sort of comments on it. So they might have missed the mark there, but at the same time, it might be strategic to not comment on that at the same time, because there are still so many open questions, and I don't know. We keep saying time will tell, and we'll see, you know, how the, say, for example, the EUA Act will work in practice, and how AI may shift under new regulations released by different countries and stuff. But, you know, when?
No, like, I agree.
There's still so many questions.
So many questions. I think it's just a method is just open so many bars and windows, and there is no answers at all. And just always considering the specific case, or can work, for example, now can work, but nothing is specific. And I understand that, because this is such a dynamic and a new world. And to be honest, I think even the legislator, there are no answers, is it? So I think probably the way could be the creation of guidelines and, like, probably specific scenarios where just made you think. And in specific for these AI systems, like the AI models, as we know, like, often rely in large data sets that include, like, very public available personal data. And the fact that we can just rely probably in legitimate interest in here can just, it's just unclear. So I'm not sure about what to do in this instance. And if a case comes through, not sure what will be our approach on this.
Yeah, I feel like there's two sides as well, isn't there? There's the wait and see what happens to then legislate on it and probably do that in a more direct and appropriate way. Or there's, you know, set these foundations and I suppose responsibilities in place for then organizations as that some. Use AI or train AI or create it to comply with. But yeah, I think, you know, in that, especially obviously there's the EUA Act, but say in this country, for example, it, the risk to individuals' privacy is, you know, is one, and everything within that is diminishing more and more by the day, really.
Yeah, I agree. I
feel like Kate and I were talking earlier about, I don't know if you've seen it, the Meta Ray-Ban glasses.
Yeah, I mentioned it last week because I was driving around somewhere and I heard a news story on Radio 4. And I mentioned it last week that I'd heard it, but it was interesting to now read it. So, yeah, it was fascinating, really. But when they interviewed this chap on Radio 4, he was saying that he was not going to commercialise the technology that he'd designed. So basically hacked some Ray-Ban glasses, hadn't he? And he's kind of written this code to do this instant identification of people. I was aware of it, yeah.
Yeah, that was it. Was it the uni student?
Yeah, that's right.
Is that
the one? Harvard.
Yeah. It's really interesting, actually. There's a video on it. I don't know if it's worth sharing it. Yeah. It might be worth sharing it because, you know, he's talking over it so listeners can keep up with what's going on as well. But it's quite scary, to be honest. My laptop is just loaded.
Yeah, the article I've put in from the Telegraph is behind a cookie paywall. We'll have to talk about cookie paywall as well, because there've been some opinions about that. So, apologies if that's behind a paywall. I'll have to maybe PDF it or something.
You know, if you share your screen, does it play sound as well?
Oh, I think there's some settings you have to do.
Really? Oh, that's a shame. I should have looked into that before, really. But yeah, it's basically, I can hear it. Let me just mute it. So he's basically, I don't know how you'll call it. He's linked Meta AI glasses, Ray-Ban glasses, with some technology in which it's got an AI database, so it can recognize people through facial recognition while recording on the glasses, and search the internet for relevant information relating to this person, find, you know, their name, their address, the the education, the family information, if the, you know, some, if it's available somewhere. And it's really scary, actually. He's within the video, I'll put a link in the chat, actually, because it's really interesting to watch. But he approaches random people and he says, you know, is your name blah de blah. In this instance here, he's pretending that he's met her before. And he's like, oh yeah, you taught this seminar, or you attended this event, etc. And she's like, oh yeah, I did. He's like, oh, it's nice to see you again, how have you been doing? She's never met him before, he's never met her before, but obviously, you know, he's got this information on his phone in front of him that says everything about her, that, you know, enough to incite a conversation. So yeah, it's a new world, really, isn't it? James has said stalker vibes.
Stalker vibes.
You know, the misuse that this could be put towards is actually terrifying. But he's within. Let me put the article in as well. Mm-hmm. I'll stop sharing my screen. But he's shared. He wrote an article on it and how to, I suppose, take your information off these databases that are used, but I think the typically Americans, probably way more out there across the world, really. But yeah, it's how to remove or prevent from being searchable. I'll put the news article in and then his article second. But yeah, it's quite terrifying, really. So, you know, while we're sat on the sidelines debating whether to impose, whether to, you know, provide a bill for the regulation of AI at the moment, you know, this is happening. And even taking it back a step, and these glasses in and of themselves, it's the amount of risks there are around that, and yeah, intrusion around that is just massive. You know, we say,
scary,
for example,
it's really scary.
With regard to personal data, you know, we've got the GDPR, but in these instances, if somebody buys these and decide to open a social media account and start vlogging, they might become a controller in their own right and don't realize the responsibility that they hold. Is the GDPR really sufficient, or is it getting watered down in that instance? There's a lot. There's a lot.
I think probably the thing that most scary is, like, because in terms of how the glasses look like, is they are just regular normal glasses. So how the people outside from the rest of people know that you actually are using them and you are actually collecting and building, in the end of the day, you are building a profile about them. So you can see everything, and just, it's just scary. And I'm just thinking as well, like, in terms of probably responsibility, like, should, like, the, for example, Ray-Ban should be, like, required to have any, I don't know, safeguards implemented in these products, should be, like, just formatted to be completely responsible? Are they, I mean, will be Meta held the responsibility to ensure that these devices will be not used or aren't used for privacy violations? How can you just, you know, like, address these, all these questions? I don't know. It's scary.
I don't know what you would say the relationship is, because, you know, if it's used for personal use, then you know, Meta would be, or is it Meta, or it links to your phone, so I don't know, whatever phone you've got as well, they will be the data controllers, or maybe I don't know, my thoughts are going off on one of them.
Yeah, this is just
I can't speak clearly, but so I'm just trying to play it out, because controllers and processes, it can be so complex at times. But Meta, you know, if they're collecting this data through recording, they will be the controller. Let's say that the recordings are for personal use only. Yeah. Then where that information is stored, so say if it's on your Apple or Android phone, would they be the processor, or would they be a controller as well?
Depends what they're doing, doesn't it, at the end of the day?
Yeah.
It's going to be quite a complex relationship. But the people who get off scot-free, really, are Ray-Ban, who are just providing the kit.
So would you say they're the processor then?
The processor.
No, they're just providing a platform,
Ray-Ban,
aren't they?
Yeah. See what you mean. Yeah.
They've
got Meta has a, I don't know, like a privacy, like, information page. Not necessarily a policy, I'm assuming they've got that too, but, you know, I've not looked at that. And it's just a fact sheet almost on how you can control your data and, you know, your responsibilities around owning a pair of these glasses. And I just don't think it goes far enough. So
what jurisdiction is it written for? I mean, I was interested to see that the CCPA is getting amended, and the definition of personal information is getting slightly modified. But when I looked at it, you know, again today, just to remind myself, you know, the definition of personal information relates to consumers and households, and a consumer is somebody lives in California. So, you know, everyone holds or seems to hold the CCPA up as this like great, you know, thing, but I think it's very weak. But I mean, you know, what jurisdiction is Meta aiming to provide for when it's writing these guidance notes?
Yeah, I mean, that is a good question. Probably it's obviously got a responsibility across, like, globally, really, but I've not read the privacy policy, so I can't really say, but it just provides some guidance and
around the glasses, really. Isn't it, and the controls, and trying to promote them rather than explain what in terms of privacy concerns or what to consider, more like promotion of the glasses and how amazing they are.
Yeah, it's quite stupid, really. One of the measures, it says how to wear smart glasses responsibly. And one of the recommendations says to show others when you're capturing, be respectful of people nearby, use your voice or a clear gesture when controlling your glasses to let them know that you're about to capture, particularly before going live. If you're out in public, you're not going to be shouting, I'm recording,
Yeah.
And then the next 5 seconds
if you don't want,
later,
please leave.
People walk past it again, like, it's just not going to happen.
Can you think of a legitimate reason to use them? I mean, what would be a legitimate purpose for using them?
It's almost just, it's like a toy, really, isn't it? Yeah. It's like having a GoPro on your head or taking your phone out to take a video. I think that's it, really.
It's not, though, is it? Because it goes a step further. I mean, taking photographs or videos of people is, you know, theoretically nothing wrong with that. It's when you start linking it to systems that will then recognize them and then trawl and find information, present you with information about them. I mean, it must be an absolute dream for social engineering. Absolute dream for social engineering. Oh, hello, Jasmine. Don't you remember me? Can I borrow your access card to get through the door? I work on the fifth floor. Yeah. I mean, it's ridiculous. I mean, But I can't think of a legitimate use for them.
Yeah. I mean, I don't know. I think people, the way I would see it is literally just as a new toy, people getting excited about it and just trying them out. And then people taking that a step further and, you know, vlogging through them for social media accounts and whatnot. I think it'd just give a different perspective. I think it'd be something that would blow up online. I think that's where my head would go with it from, you know, like a younger generation perspective, like as younger people, you know, they grow up in this world and it's more of a norm to them. But one of the funny things about it is as well that when it's recording, it has this tiny light in the top corner to show people that you're recording, but I wouldn't have known that unless I hadn't, you know, accessed this page and seen what they look like. The scale of, you know, people that will not recognize that they're being recorded through that, and even you can just turn it on, you know, discreetly, look at someone opening the phone with the password, or entering a building with a PIN code or something like that, you know, and it's capturing that with without people really being aware. It's
there's some good questions. I mean, Carl's mentioned about I had to Google it because I didn't know what it was, but actually I'm fairly face blind. I don't recognize my own kids sometimes. I remember them coming out of school and I'm thinking, is that Izzy? Oh, that's Izzy. She's right at the car now.
Yeah, that's mine.
I'm not very good at recognizing faces. And I'm hopeless at associating names with them. So I get that it would be useful in those circumstances. And also, you know, for blind people as well, that is a brilliant use case where you can't see the person, but the system could tell you who it was that you were in proximity to.
Mm-hmm. That's a really good point.
Mm-hmm. I mean, that would be very, very, very helpful, but in terms of privacy...
A prescription product, maybe. A prescription product. Rather than a commercially available product. Anyway, yeah, some good use cases there.
Yeah.
Right. So So I'd heard about that. That's really quite interesting development, isn't it? See where that goes, I guess.
And they are so cheap, aren't they? It's just how can you assess to all this information? And then I thought, like, okay, probably this will be like at least $1,000, something like that. No, just $300, isn't it? So really, really affordable. So yeah.
And with that, you know, so we're talking about personal use there. If it goes beyond that, how do you actually control that as a regulator, data protection regulator within a country, or, you know, applying the legislation to so many people? Is it not out of control, or is it not going that way?
It sounds to be going that way. Interestingly, you mentioned that, but I don't even know the notice. The ICAO has got a list of upcoming changes to their guidance. And on that happening, there's a lot happening. I'll put a link in what's happening in winter 2024. One of the things they say is going to happen in winter 24 is this new audit framework, which they've obviously produced. But other things that they're going to publish or republish in winter 2024 are domestic CCTV guidelines for the public. This is an update of existing guidance to address some primary complaints that have been raised. Now, you know, will they incorporate this, or is this going to be too new? Be interesting to see. So other things, again, of real interest to us, I think, being updated is guidance around substantial public interest conditions. So this is additional content to explain how these conditions work, which I think will be really useful,
when that
comes out. And also they're developing a tool for users to help them evaluate whether these substantial public interest conditions are going to work in certain use cases. So that should be good. They're producing consent or pay public facing policy position. I think that's just a positioning paper for data controllers to ensure, you know, have to consider how consent or pay models comply with e-privacy law and UK data protection law. New guidance update to existing guidance on scanning children's fingerprints in schools. That's coming out this quarter. A direct marketing tool to help SMEs to understand what steps to take when sending direct marketing through different channels. I guess that's in response to all the fines that they have been issuing for SMSs and so on and so forth. The guidance on the use of storage and access technologies. Again, this should be really good because this is updated guidance for online service providers using storage and access technologies. And this is to help comply with the PECA. So that must be to do with like tagging and pixels and so on and so forth. They're also updating their employment records guidance, new guidelines on data protection and employment records. This is a whole set of new guidance they're producing on data protection and employment. And then the last one that I thought was interesting, there's quite a long list, I'll put the link to it in a second, is they're updating FOIA Section 41 guidance. This is information provided in confidence. This is, again, this is going to include tribunal and case examples. So again, I think that'd be really useful as well. So some really good stuff that they're working on.
And
if it's as good as the accountability trackers and the audit trackers, then it should be really good quality stuff. Finding it's being published and then finding it and accessing it is always a challenge. I don't know if you noticed, but the currently I've got warnings up saying you can't PDF some of our content. Oh, really?
Why is that? Because it's older, or...?
Well, no, but technically, they want you to go online and find it. But I find it really hard to work with something that's so interactive. It's very hard to find you. I was looking this week, because we're going down to the Do's Audit, and the organisation we're auditing has fundraisers out and about on the street. And we've downloaded their document set to see what they actually provide in terms of privacy information when these third-party fundraisers are out there, because you are initiating that kind of that work. So I went on the Direct Marketing Guidance to find out, because I know that they say if you instigate the work, then you're responsible for it. Couldn't find it online at all. So I happened to have a PDF copy of the Direct Marketing Guidance, but I found it like 2 seconds because you just do a search. But because the web page is... You know, you can only search that web page. It's not on that web page, but it's in that guidance.
Yeah.
You just spend hours trawling around trying to find what you know is there. I just find it really hard to use their guidance often.
Yeah. When I'm looking for something on the ICO's website, I'll have to search in Google, you know, exactly what I'm looking for in the hope that it takes me to the right page rather than searching through page after page of the ICO's, or even using the search function in the ICO's website, because that is never provides what I'm looking for. But I don't know if you've seen on that sounds really interesting though, Phil. I'm looking forward to seeing what comes from that. there was a lot there. I had a few thoughts on a couple, but
I'm really excited. I'm really excited about the substantial public.
Yeah, hang on, here it is. I'll put it into the chat here. Right, this is the list of stuff that I thought was useful. There's more, you know, and there's a lot of stuff in there. But this is what I thought would be, you know, really quite useful for us as practitioners. There's quite a lot there. Yeah. The other thing I got involved with this week is I wanted to check out, because I'd kind of forgotten that they did this, some of the ICO's training videos. So I went and had a look at the rights request handling training videos, and it comes with some associated downloadable resources. You know, again, really quite useful stuff to use internally. It was all right, you know, but it's all there to be used, you know, so we don't have to recreate the wheel. You know, there is some good work that the ICO, we do often slate them, but they do some good work as well.
Yeah, that was one of them on the consent or pay model. So I'm intrigued to see what they say about that, because it took me back. I think you put, you sent across an article on advancements that the European Data Protection Board had made, you know, they're just an article written by someone. And the opinion that was formed on consent or pay by the European Data Protection Board.
Yeah.
I remember it saying that, you know, that it shouldn't be the default approach to this, you know, to targeted advertising or consent for advertising. And I don't really understand that, because it was determined that that means that, you know, the consent isn't valid if it's not freely given, because you're forced to either pay for non-targeted ads or, you know, not pay for targeted ads, kind of thing. So, you know, you don't have a free choice there, because if you don't want them, you know, you have to pay. And I don't understand how the wording suggests that there might be some instances where it's acceptable. I don't know if you've got any thoughts on that.
I'm just trying to find my notes on it, to be honest, Jasmine. I was hoping to find them whilst you were talking, but I've not got there in time. I can't find them at all, actually. I don't know. I mean, I'd have to reread the guidance, to be honest. I can't remember exactly what it said, if I'm being honest.
I'm just reading the chat. Amy said the free choices done use sites that do consent or pay it. Sorry, I don't know what you mean.
So don't use them. Yeah, free choices. Don't use the site.
Oh, they don't.
Yeah.
Right, it's just a typo.
So yeah, that's I suppose one choice, isn't it? I think that I thought that the angle was, you know, that, you know, it shouldn't be that kind of Boolean do use it or don't use it. It's like, want to use it. People should be allowed to use this information, but not have to pay for it, not have to consent. You know, so that some kind of, you know, work around. I don't know. I need to think about that, to be honest. Look at it again.
Okay, no problem.
If I can find out. I don't know where we got the information on it.
I don't know if you've seen over the last week that the government has referred itself to the ICO for accidentally CCing over 100 invitees to an investment summit, you know, in an email rather than BCC, I suppose. It doesn't specify that part. But the breach included the email address of one of the world's richest men, Bernard Arnault. I don't know if I'm saying that right. He's a French tycoon, essentially, who founded and owns the luxury goods firm LVMH, which is champagne, yeah. and Louis Vuitton. I don't know if you've seen that.
No, I didn't see that. No. Was it a big problem? Or
it was over 100 of the invitees, and obviously these are going to be well renowned people. I think, to be honest. There was the article that I read included, you know, some big names. Some of them I've not heard of. They're obviously just quite successful. I did note that Elon Musk hadn't been invited because of his comments online after, you know, the riots and whatnot. But he is within that conversation. So obviously there is some, you know, there is some level of risk in their information being disclosed or breached. So that is obviously probably why it got reported to the ICO. But it just goes to show, you know, that in disclosing an email address by accident, it can be seen as such low level risk attached to it, but also on the other end, it might, you know, it can be used for such misuse as well. Yeah.
On that, we have recently, we have a client of ours, Housing Association, that had more or less the same problem. So one employee from the customer service, I think, send an email to a lot of tenants, but rather than CC all of them. And the email per se was just the names and the email addresses would thought in the first instance, but the content of the email was an invite that was just for vulnerable people. So one thing that could be low risk in principle, because of the content of the email and the fact that this email was just direction to an audience that was considered vulnerable, and per se, probably special category data will be here involved and more details, would automatically go to medium high risk ones. So it could be, is interesting. Yeah. And I remember that the time that the approach was like, it was just an email, so we'll be fine. It's not like that. So we need to assess that it's just not an email and then send could be the content. Yeah.
In a similar fashion as well. So I don't know if you've seen that the ICO issued a reprimand to Southend-on-Sea City Council for disclosing employee details similar to the Police Service of Northern Ireland's breach within a spreadsheet, within hidden rows, as part of, you know, a request response under the Freedom of Information Act. And yeah, the fact that a reprimand was issued for this, you know, as opposed to the fine that was provided to the or issued to the Police Service of Northern Ireland, again, draws distinctions in what would be, you know, the same information. I think similar information, at least disclosed in this instance, carries much a very different level of risk to it. But I found it quite interesting within this that one of the, I suppose, causes for concerns or aggravating factors was the fact that in the intention for being transparent, the council announced its breach, I suppose, publicly, in the public communications anyway, which could have alerted people in possession of this information or who could gain access to this information to the hidden data, you know, so they, it could go into the wrong hands or could be in the wrong hands without realizing, and that just increases the risk posed to the people's data, you know, to the people whose data was breached.
That's really interesting.
Yeah. I found the blog that, sorry, carry on.
I was just going to say, some of my customers over the time, you know, they've had the approach of, you know, notify data subjects of any personal data breach in every instance. And it's not always, you know, it's not always a good thing. It's not always the right approach. It can carry its own risks in doing that. Aside from risk to reputation, obviously in this instance, it might not have been to the data subjects. It's been to anyone else, really. But, you know, if it is to the data subjects, then that can even cause distress to them where there is low risk and, you know, they probably didn't need to know about it. I see, you know, in some instances, it might be the best thing to do if they were going to find out about it anyway. But it's something to, you know, just think about rather than applying a blanket policy for all. Yeah.
So I've just posted that thing because I found the reason why I couldn't find the content up thing was because all the notes were collapsed, you know, using Microsoft Word section headers. But I put a link in there. It's quite, what was interesting about this was that it's kind of just an opinion from a law firm. They're covering off, you know, the kind of attitude and approach to cookies and digital marketing. So one of the things that they highlighted, as you rightly say, Jasmine, is, you know, this consent or pay. And what the article is saying is that, you know, the European Data Protection Board stamps is narrowing down the options for advertisers. Advertisers are up in arms about this and pushing back. So I think there's still a lot to play out with that. I do agree with you that, you know, it's not really a real choice, even, and they're saying that this kind of don't use a service then is not also not a real viable choice. So interesting how that plays out. But what I was really interested in this was that two data protection authorities have fined organizations for using pixels as opposed to cookies and cookie consent. So again, it's in that article there, but, you know, a fine of 130.3 million euros and 3.2 million euros and 700,000 euros have been levied for using, you know, pixels Which is quite interesting.
Yeah, the in relation to that, where the e-privacy directive has it been updated or expanded, you know, with what it will cover? Have you seen that, either of you? I'm probably not explaining it very well.
Yeah. They published a new version of the guidelines, on the article. Yeah, the article 5, paragraph 5-3. I think in those, it's just they wanted to, those guidelines wanted to expand what is normally just cookies, and we think always cookies applicable, and they just want to, considering this new dynamic, just want to driven through what is considering these new technologies, and you include guidance around local processing, URL and pixel tracking, URL hours tracking based on IP only, and intermittent and mediation Internet of Things reporting.
I put a link into the, it's only a 15 page opinion, so it's probably quite short. It's open up my desktop to read. I ran out of time to read it before the session started, but I put a link into it if anyone wants to have a look at that. What I've read about it is the people saying it's fairly inconclusive still, doesn't really provide that much substance to go off, but I've not read it myself yet.
Yeah.
Did you see that Cassia, I mean, when I'm shifting on to kind of ransomware attacks, because I'm interested to see, you know, we have a client who had a ransomware attack last 2 weeks ago. I'm not entirely sure where they're up to with it. But the Casio have suffered a ransomware attack on the 7th of October, and they're still locked out of their systems 2 weeks on. That's reported in TechRadar. Interesting. Then, but I also read an article about the levels of stress and the burnout rate of CISOs, chief information security officers. I'll try and find that link and put it in the chat as well. It's basically saying that, you know, surveys are showing that, you know, massive, like 93% of chief information security officers are saying, you know, the stress of the workplace is causing them some real, you know, mental health and physical health problems, and there's a lot of them looking to quit. They're hard to replace, so that's not a good sign at all.
On what basis? Why, you know, where does the stress come from? Is it lack of buy-in from the rest of the organization?
Lack of resources, lack of buy-in, and just this sense that you're constantly, you know, got all these adversaries that are trying to outmaneuver you, you know.
Is it the news that you posted as the Casium systems were unusable for almost 2 weeks, weren't they? So there was no recovery at all. So there was like these major operational systems that were unusable. No?
Well,
I think I read something around that.
I don't know, possibly. But the last time I was directly personally involved in a ransomware attack at one of our customers, it was a small charity, and it was their supplier that got attacked. You know, the supplier of their Microsoft Office systems. And it locked them out of everything for about 3 months. They couldn't do anything. No fundraising, no accounting, no HR, no donor flex, nothing. Everything got completely locked out, which is a massive problem operationally.
Oh, I wonder in terms of consequences, and the operational could be...
Huge consequences. Oh, yeah, they operate shops. Wow. They operate shops. They operate some very, very technical medical-oriented equipment services. Can't say too much, but it was a massive problem. So, you know, and this kind of cyber burnout crisis, you know, they say is reaching breaking point. I read an article, Microsoft have got a report out saying that the number of ransomware attacks has increased by nearly 300% since last year. But they reckon that their software, not their software, but the software in general, is getting better at trapping it. And the weak link is still social engineering attacks. So, you know, roll on, bring on the Ray-Ban glasses.
Exactly, to identify where you are.
That's good to see, though, you know, that the defences are getting better against... Because I swear I read that the defences are getting better threefold in comparison to last year as well, which is more so than, you know, than there have been attacks if you look at it mathematically or statistically. I don't know. My maths has gone terrible since school. I mean, you know, as technology advances, there's always going to be new ways to penetrate, you know, systems and security weaknesses. But, you know, if we're keeping up to that from a technical aspect, then that's
it's a game of cat and mouse, isn't it, unfortunately? Well, yeah, except it's a game of cat and mouse. So at the moment, you know, arguably, you know, we're on the front foot from a defensive point of view, but it won't be long before, you know, the attackers get new techniques, new technology. And you know, the weakest link is still the human. Whether it's a weak password or a human that you can manipulate through social engineering, it's still the human that's the problem.
How do you combat that apart from training and more training and bashing your head against the wall and training?
Well, I think you sound like a under pressure CISO. Oh God, I can't. What can I do? Stress, you know.
Yeah,
you're right. It's hard, isn't it?
One of my old accounts, they used to do, I think, maybe like quarterly or at least periodic phishing practices, you know, where they'd do, I don't know what you call it, but basically training exercises to catch staff who would fall for phishing attempts. Ah. And then those that would click the link, then they'd provide them with more training. And they did this exercise like at least 3 times within 1 year for the same people, you know, those who kept clicking the links. And the numbers that they'd, you know, give back on how many people were still falling for these links was stupidly high at that point on a personal individual level. Like, you can't keep falling for this if you've had, you know, training at least twice on this issue. And at that point they were like, what can we actually do? And I don't really know.
Well, I went to a talk last year. It was a conference in London, and I only went down because Ernst & Young and KnowBe4 were doing this talk on changing culture in the workplace. And the guy from Ernst & Young said that they took that, he was for the head of cyber security, and he said that they took that attitude of, we're going to test people and we're going to look out and we're going to punish them if they fail. He said, we would turn it on its head, and we have phishing tournaments, and we challenge people to find the phishing activity, and then we have a tournament, and who comes, you know, who picks up the most wins a trophy, you know. And I thought that was a really good idea.
Yeah.
He said before they did that, all the partners in Ernst & Young would say, you know, that's nothing to do with me. Leave it to the admin lot. Now they're all trying to compete to win the tournament.
Yeah. Incentives.
So just that, that's the one thing I took away from that conference. That one change in approach.
Yeah.
You know, change the emphasis has had a major impact on their ability to, you know, filter out phishing attacks.
Emma said in the chat, someone in my team clicked the link because he wanted to see what happened if he did, even though he knew it was a training phishing email. That's quite funny. I nearly got caught by one. I don't know if I said it on here a couple of weeks ago, which I knew was a phishing email as well. And it was just it was threatening without being threatening almost. I got a dodgy email on my, I just checked my junk mail, and it was like, it just basically said my name, my email address, my phone number. No, not my email. Well, it sent it to my email address, my name, my home address, and my phone number. And it was like, click here to unsubscribe or something like that. And I was like, I don't want it to have it. And I was like, I'm tempted to. It's quite.
You just can't trust anything, like, though, can you?
Yeah.
Psychologically messing with me because I know it's a phishing email, but I don't want them to message me.
Shane, you just can't trust anything. So I got an email from. Yeah, I got an email purporting to be from booking.com yesterday saying that they were going to upgrade me. They knew I was going to London next week to stay, you know, down to this audit. And it was click here to upgrade. We've got all these rooms upgraded. So I thought, well, I'm not going to click on that because it could well be a phishing exercise or something. But how do they know that I've got a reservation? But, you know, it's not beyond the realms of possibility that there's been some kind of breach. Anyway, I went on to the booking.com platform.
It's interesting.
Booking.com. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so independently, I went onto the booking.com platform, went to the thing, looked for the messages. I could not find anything, actually. I looked at the property, couldn't find any option to upgrade. I thought, well, that's definitely a phishing exercise. But then I clicked on the messages thing within booking.com, and there it was, this message. Weather. So it was an official message, but I still didn't trust it. It was definitely from booking.com. It had been, because it was in the transcript of messages from booking.com on their website. But the fact it had come in via my email, I thought... So easy to click on something, but
it's really.
I've had a couple from booking.com that are definitely phishing emails, you know, when you look at the email address that it's come from. I don't know if I have actually changed my password for booking.com, but I should do. You know, because it's as soon as I've booked somewhere, then a day after, it's just very strange timing. And you know, it'll be relating to a booking, but then the booking's not the actual one that I've made. And, you know, it's quite dodgy. So,
yeah. But did you hear again? I was alerted to my wife actually alerted to the deep fake voices, where you know, a couple of seconds worth of voice can be then used to deep fake a voice. So the next phase is, you know, like you ring somebody up, like, hello, you know, put the phone down. So is that enough to then use that to do an AI version of your daughter, your boyfriend, your husband, whatever, to try and, or your boss, to try and, you know, social engineer? Yeah, it probably will be. Like, it's scary stuff that's happening.
That's really scary.
Well, we're buggered, aren't we? No hope for us.
We cannot trust anyone.
That's it. Throw the towel in, Jazz.
That's it for the podcast. Never see us again. I saw a video on LinkedIn this morning, and it just reminded me how there's like scamming opportunities everywhere. It was, I don't know, like a poster on somewhere outside, like a lamppost or a bus stop or something like that, and it was from a charity, you know, saying click here to donate, and it was there was a barcode that you could scan, and someone had, I don't know if it was for the purpose of the video or if it was something that they'd actually come across, they started peeling away this barcode, and underneath was the actual barcode. So some, as if someone had stuck on, you know, their own barcode, which would link to their own website or GoFundMe.
I bet that happens. Wow. I bet that happens a lot, actually.
Yeah. Mm. Still, I can't help but be impressed.
Yeah.
So clever. But it is terrible at the same time. You know, it's scary that these opportunities are all around, and you know, it's luck at some point, you know, to some level.
I had a situation in Portugal that was around like the withdrawals machines, the money, so they tried to just copy all the numbers that just have, it's just insane, just cannot trust anything.
yeah Amy said in the chat they do that on the car park ticket machines as well. That's the one that I've seen. Yeah. Fake QR codes on, yeah. So thank you for that. But yeah, it's it is clever, but it's, you know, you do have to be one step ahead of the game. So where, you know, you can raise your own awareness and caution, it's definitely worth doing so.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Now I noticed that you wanted to talk about, I don't know if we've got time left, about the European Data Protection Board's opinion on processes and subprocesses. Have you seen that this week? I don't know if there's anything you want to flag up about that.
Yeah, so the European Data Protection Board adopted an opinion on certain obligations from the reliance on processor and subprocessors following a request to the European Data Protection Board by the Danish Data Protection Authority. So the opinion is about situations where the controller relies on one or more processors and subprocessors. In particular, it addresses 8 questions on the interpretation of duties, well, of certain duties of controllers relying on subprocessors and subprocessors, as well as the wording of controller processor contracts arising in particular from Article 28. So the opinion explains that the controller should have the information on the identity, including the name and address and contacts person of all processors and subprocessors, readily available at all times so they can best fulfill their obligations under Article 28. Besides, the controller's obligation to verify whether the subprocessors or processors present sufficient guarantees should apply regardless of the risks to the rights and freedoms of data subjects, although the extent of such verification may vary, notably on the basis of the risks associated with the processing. And it also states that while the initial processor should ensure that it proposes subprocessors with sufficient guarantees, the ultimate decision and responsibility on engaging a specific subprocessor remains with the controller. So ultimately, you know, while there are responsibilities on processors for organizations and suppliers that it works with, the ultimate responsibility is still with the controller.
But does that also extend to restricted transfers? So with the ICO view, I think is that it's up to the processor chain to organize air restrictive transfers, mm-hmm. you know, only going a step up in the chain. So a processor would ensure that a sub-processor restricted transfers are got appropriate mechanism for them, rather than going all the way up the chain to the controller.
Amy said in the chat, it's like red lorry, yellow lorry.
Go on, say that a few more times, Jasmine. Go on.
It really is. Yeah, sorry if you couldn't keep up with that one. No, so it says that in addition, where transfers of personal data outside of the European Economic Area take place between two sub-processors or processors, mm-hmm. the processor as the data exporter should prepare all the relevant documentation, such as relating to the ground of transfer used, the transfer impact assessment, and possible supplementary measures. However, as the controller is still subject to the duties stemming from Article 28 on sufficient guarantees, besides the one under Article 44 to ensure that the level of protection is not undermined by transfers of personal data, it should assess this documentation and be able to show it to the competent data protection authority. So, yeah, the controller still needs to have some sort of oversight, even though it is for the processor to, mm-hmm. You know, to undertake this these activities or, mm-hmm. or measures. But at the same time, you know, while it provides this opinion, I still don't know how far down the supply chain you're supposed to go.
And you know, I'm not sure about what you think about this, but I have a few concerns around these guidance, because, for example, the first one, when you need to identify all the processors, sub-processors, and all the supply chain, it's just a burden. How can you keep making sure that this information is up to date and is really in practice, it's really, really burdensome when we are dealing, for example, with a large network of processors and sub-processors and now forward. And I think putting these burden on the controllers and making sure that they still have, I understand, but that they still have some responsibility, even in a situation processor, sub-processor, is just, it can trigger some practical issues. And even for like the transfers, the controllers may not have a fully visibility about all the international data transfers that is going on. So making them, in the end of the day, still responsible to check that and say, yes, I'm all right with this, can be
I think it needs properly testing. So I have these opinions, but I've always wondered mm-hmm. what sufficient guarantees means, you know, in practice. So where processes carried out on behalf of controller, the controller shall use only processes providing sufficient guarantees to do what? To implement appropriate technical and organizational measures in such a manner that the process meets the regulation, blah, 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 blah. Well, what does that mean in practice? Surely in practice, that goes to the extent of saying we've got a contract that gives us, you know, contractual means to ensure that there are sufficient guarantees in place. That should be sufficient. I think the whole thing needs really looking at in detail and testing through the course, really, and someone to kind of defend themselves, saying, you know, the processor guaranteed that they were going to do this thing, they signed a contract, you know, and well, that should be sufficient, because that's all the GDPR requires. It surely doesn't require a controller to have a grasp of all the sub-processors in the whole supply chain. I mean, mm-hmm. we use Salesforce, right? You know, and that's our main processor, but they have 15 sub-processors that we see update us of every mm-hmm. Few months. But, mm-hmm. you know, if those sub-processors have got sub-processors and sub-processors, it's an enormous chain.
I'm thinking about even for the smaller organizations that have fewer resources and definitely can struggle to just conduct all these assessments for each processor, sub-processor, and even to understand, and probably for, should be like a distinction between like low risk processing, or I don't know, how can you control? Yeah.
I think,
you should be on the data protection board, Katrina.
The distinction here is the difference between theory and practice, which seems to be like an underlying theme and the difficulty here. And I think there's levels to that as well. So, you know, Phil, you're talking about sufficient guarantees. Shouldn't that be the contract itself? In my mind, there's a risk that the contract is the theory, but the due diligence, for example, is the actual practical element of checking, you know, whether they do actually do this in practice and whether you can be sure. Mm-hmm. But the scale of that then is where, you know, it's it's how it should work in theory, but it can't work in practice.
Yeah.
It's quite complex.
Just a quick one. I keep looking at this picture in the chat of this fellow with his head in his hands, and I keep thinking it's one of the participants on the thing. I think, oh, crikey, must be. There's somebody there with their head in their hands like this.
Well, on that note, we'll leave to enjoy your weekend, as this man clearly will. we hope you enjoyed the session. We'll be back next week for an episode on AI, so you know, keep an ear out for that one. We hope to see you there. But yeah, in the meantime, thank you, Phil and Katarina, for joining me on the session.
Oh, thank you
everyone for listening.